This only have I found. God created mankind upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes.
Morning, everyone. Oh, no, has anyone heard of the Mozart effect? It was something that I was reading about this week. But in the 1990s, researchers discovered this so-called Mozart effect, which is listening to Mozart briefly boosted students' test performance in particular areas. But the problem was that the media kind of exaggerated this when they caught on to what was happening, and it kind of became this self-help craze with parents and even in the state government in Georgia in the US giving babies classical CDs in the hope that it would make them smarter. But I wonder, what does that tell us about what we're like as people? I wonder if it shows us our instinct, that is, that we see knowledge as a tool for control. It's something for me to use and manipulate so that I can get what I want out of life. I think we have this strong bent towards control. We want to be masters of our own destiny. We act like gods, using whatever's at our fingertips to fashion the life that we want for us. But today's passage shows us that that's not wisdom. True wisdom begins where our human control ends. And we're going to see that this touches on every area of our lives. We can approach religion with this mindset. There are those who offer food to the local gods or spirits with the hope that they will bless their new truck as harvest time approaches. Or closer to home, we can live by a form of Christianity that thinks if we do things for God, he'll respond by showing us favour. Perhaps we think if we take on certain ministry commitments, God will give us material blessing, that lifestyle that we want, where he'll guarantee health or happiness. We might even approach our suffering with some kind of control mindset. I was speaking with Haley's mum in the course of this week, and she was just sharing about how her dad tried to control life. He faced the loss of her brother, that's Haley's uncle, and then his wife also was diagnosed with breast cancer, which ended up taking her life. And at these kind of points in his life, he would reassure himself saying, we've just got to get through this. Then things will settle down. Then we'll be able to get back to getting what we want out of life. But whether it's our approach to the latest craze in pop psychology, the latest AI development that's going to revolutionize our lives, unhelpful ways we can approach our faith, or kind of beliefs that surface in the face of suffering, the teacher in Ecclesiastes is holding out for us a different path. He says, true wisdom begins where our human control ends. And as we go, he's going to show us the how. How to give up human control and live by true wisdom before God. Let's get into our first point. Our first point is true wisdom begins when we submit to God. Verses 13 and 14. First, we see God is our maker in verse 13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? We're to consider what God has done. Now, some people at this point, they want to write the teacher off. They want to say he's a cynic. How can he claim that God has made something crooked? But remember, Ecclesiastes is like this extended sermon on life in this world. It was created good by God, but it's not afraid to unpack life in all its brokenness after the fall. God did make this world good, but as we read elsewhere in the Bible, he subjected it to frustration. Try as we might, we can't straighten out all that's broken with this world. Only God can set things straight. And we know from the whole Bible that it's a work in progress that's well underway. Jesus came healing disease and sickness, casting out demons, showing his power over a chaotic creation. And these are like signposts pointing to the full renewal that's to come. Now he's restoring people to himself, one person at a time. That's the big picture. How can we submit to God as our maker? Let's look at the first half of verse 14. When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. So we submit to God by celebrating the good times, by being happy. And Zacchaeus wants to help me to grasp this. He's talking about how sometimes we can feel guilty about feeling happy when we have the blessing of sweet circumstances. Does God really want me to enjoy this new job, this tasty meal, this new TV series? Or should I kind of hide that from him? Maybe he doesn't approve of it. No, be happy. Feel the enjoyment. This is what God intends. But when trouble comes our way, then there's opportunity to consider. That hard thing that comes to you has come your way under God's good care of your life. There's something humbling about all this. The second half of verse 14. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. You see, wisdom is limited. We can't use it to find out what's ahead. But we do know the one who is good and who rules over the details of our lives, the blessings and the hardships. What's the teacher's message? True wisdom begins where our human control ends. And here's our first way to give up control. Submit to God. I wonder if it's like assembling IKEA furniture, but without instructions. Anyone had that experience? Ever been in that situation? I don't want to waste time with the instructions. I'll be able to figure this out. But you get to that step where it's just not coming together and it kind of backfires. And you realize that life only makes sense when you follow the maker's design. So in humility, we go back to those instructions. We consult them. We submit to the one who made that piece of furniture. Well, as we learn true wisdom by submitting to God, we see that he rules over all the seasons of our life. As we read back in chapter 3 some time ago, he has made everything beautiful in its time. We allow ourselves to feel joy over God's good provision for us. When we're experiencing good, that's not the time to consider. It's the time to enjoy, to receive with thanks. But when we face trouble, allow that to sit with us. Set our heart and mind on that awful thing. As our guest one says, take lots of time to grieve, to ask questions, to wrestle with it, to work it out and come to terms. And let's stop pretending that we can know our future. We plan and we aim to be faithful with what God has given to us, but nothing is certain. Good and bad happens to all, but always under God's fatherly care. That brings us to our second point. True wisdom begins when we fear God. Verses 15 to 22. True wisdom begins when we fear God. So the teacher observes that there's two categories of people in verse 15. In this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these. The righteous perishing in their righteousness, and the wicked living long in their wickedness. And he's going to unpack a caution, a word of caution about each. Our first are those who chase righteousness and wisdom in verse 16. Do not be over righteous, neither be over wise. Why destroy yourself? Now, this actually sounds a bit shocking. Is he telling us not to be too good? That being good actually harms us? Let's look at his warning about wickedness in verse 17. Do not be over wicked and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? Is he saying a little evil is okay? Just don't go too far with it. perhaps advocating for some kind of middle ground, not too righteous and not too wicked. That's how some people read verse 18. It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. Whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Sounds a bit like a plea for a middle ground. And this section does lead some people to conclude that the teacher really isn't a trustworthy guide. He doesn't really speak accurately on God's behalf. But I think something else is going on. This is about using righteousness or wisdom as a way to manipulate God, as a way to try and control him to get what we want. The same for wickedness, kind of turning aside from what's good to suck as much as we can for ourselves out of this life. I think he's showing us that that's what human pride does. It tries to shape life to our own liking, whether by wisdom or by evil. But either way, we're going against God. I think it's helpful to note in verse 18, the extremes there is not there in the original language. It's not there in the Hebrew. So the ESV translates the verse this way. It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. So I think a life fearing God will mean avoid using wisdom or goodness as a way to guarantee what we want. And a life fearing God will avoid falling headlong into the darkness of selfishness and the mistreatment of others. And there's definitely real benefit to wisdom. And he gives us an example in verse 19. Wisdom makes one person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Having wisdom is actually better than having political or military power. But the wise person can't escape sin. We're all flawed. Listen to verse 20. Indeed, there is no one on earth who is righteous, no one who does what is right and never sins. Now he follows up with an example of a flaw in verse 21. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or they may hear your servant. You may hear your servant cursing you. What's his reason? Why shouldn't we pay attention? Verse 22, for you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. We've each cursed others. Best not to be too harsh with someone else when we've done the same thing ourselves. I'm reminded of the reality that we're more alike than different when it comes to our sin struggles. Even if our response might not be as full grown as it is in someone else, it's likely that we have the same thing in seed form in our own hearts. What's the teacher saying? He's saying true wisdom begins where our human control ends. And here's our second way to give up control. Fear God. Now suppose three children in a family, they want their dad's blessing. They want to receive all the good that could come from his hands. One says, I'll do everything that I know my dad likes. If I can only be good enough, perhaps then my dad will look at me and show me favor. The second says, you know what? Maybe my dad's blessing isn't worth it. I can get what I want if I just go my own way in life. I won't say no to anything that my eyes desire. And if anyone gets in my way, well, I'm going to make them pay. But the third concludes, I know my dad cares about me. I'm going to respect the ways that he loves and cares for me. I'm going to listen carefully to what he says. I'm going to live close to dad and involve him in my life. Which one sounds like true wisdom? It's the third, isn't it? True wisdom is profoundly relational. It's formed as we live in relationship with a living God. True wisdom begins when we fear God. How do we do that? One part is recognizing from the whole of the Bible that Jesus is the power and wisdom of God, we read elsewhere. He's actually the only one who's truly wise, who brings together all wisdom. And so when we grow in wisdom, we're not kind of on some path to greatness apart from Jesus. We're actually learning to walk more closely with him. And little by little, in real ways, we are becoming like him. Peter tells us, in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. And what we're aiming for is to get to know him more and more, to know and to taste his goodness, seeing that there's no one else quite like him, seeing him as bigger, stronger, and wiser than anyone else. That's fearing the Lord. And one way you could do this coming week would be to choose one passage about Jesus that's impacted you in the past. Could be something like John's powerful vision of Jesus in Revelation chapter 1. Maybe it's Jesus' cleansing of the leper in Mark 1, where we see his compassion, the fact that he makes the leper clean and holy and he has this power to heal. Or maybe it's his invitation to come to him for rest amidst all the pressures of a demanding world from Matthew 11. My encouragement is to sit with one of those passages at the start of the week and then each day allow that passage, that way that you think about Jesus, to shape the way you speak to him. That's one way you could do it. That brings us to our third point. True wisdom begins when we accept our limits. True wisdom begins when we accept our limits. Verses 23 to 29. And the teacher's search for wisdom has taught him some things are just beyond his reach. Listen to verse 23. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I am determined to be wise. But this was beyond me. He continues in verse 24. Whatever exists is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? Far off and most profound, here it's literally deep, deep. It's like the vastness of the ocean that's just too wide and too deep for us to get our heads around. What does the teacher do when it's beyond him? Verse 25. So I turn my mind to understand, to investigate and to search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. He's trying to organize a system of wisdom, the scheme of things. He wants to understand it all, along with the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. I think what we're seeing is this kind of ambitious task. It's actually impossible for him. Yet there are some clear conclusions he can draw. In verse 26, he shares another example where wisdom helps. I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner she will ensnare. Now remember the teacher here, it's either Solomon or someone putting himself in the shoes of Solomon. So he's speaking from a male perspective. We know how Solomon allowed his heart to be undone by the women who worshipped other gods. It's kind of like his kryptonite. He was ensnared in the bedroom. Now the problem isn't women per se. It's the sexualizing of relationships. We could reverse the genders in what Solomon's saying and that the meaning would be the same. I like how Zach Eswine puts it. We settle for something less than love. The woman the teacher is speaking about has quit on love. And instead, she wants to feel good about herself by being noticed by men. She uses her body and her words to get attention and sets a trap. She consumes rather than loves. Now, God's design for man is to use sexual power as a gift, to empower and bless women in marriage. But that's getting traded for the misuse of one another. The teacher's he knows that's empty. It's a dead end. So he goes on to describe his conclusion, verse 27. Look, says the teacher, this is what I've discovered. Adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things. Again, he's still trying to put it all together. Listen for his effort at the start of verse 28. while I was still searching but not finding. You get this kind of sense of futility and an empty search. What did he find? The second half of verse 28. I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all. This might be a bit jarring to our modern ears. Is he seeing men as superior, ruling out the possibility of an upright woman? I think here are a couple of things to keep in mind that help us. Again, as I said before, he's describing a male perspective, but it's in a context where women were very disadvantaged. So a woman's opportunity for learning kind of depended on upright men around her. So there's some kind of reflection, in a sense, back on men here, I think. But also Solomon didn't make a wise choice with the particular women he surrounded himself with, right? He didn't surround himself with women who knew God, but those who worshipped other gods, and their influence ended up turning his own heart away from the true God. I think this is a poetic way of saying there's actually hardly anyone who has the kind of contemplative wisdom and joy that we were made to have. You could only find one in 2,000. That's what he's saying. And he's including himself as a sinner. When he looks at men, women, and himself, he draws his conclusion in verse 29. This only have I found. God created man upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes. What's his conclusion? Well, as the rest of the Bible teaches, God created mankind upright, but all of us have gone in search of many schemes. Notice how he uses schemes again. Verse 25, he was searching out the scheme of things. And verse 27, adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things. I think by using that phrase again, that word, he's intentionally including himself here in verse 29. It's the tendency that we all have to turn away from God, to try and make life work without him. Even his own kind of overreach that has tried to order everything and understand it, things that were actually beyond him. Well, the teacher here has been saying, true wisdom begins where our human control ends. And here's our third way to give up control, accept our limits. I think this is like the image of the weaned baby that David uses in Psalm 131. So King David, he'd learned to rein in his pride. He'd learned not to try and go after what was beyond him. And he says this, "But I have calmed and quieted my soul, like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me." A baby that's not weaned gets restless. It's wanting milk, and it's wanting milk now. I think about eldest son Heath back when he was a baby on long car trips. He would just scream and scream until we'd finally relent, pull over the car, and Haley would feed him. But a weaned child is calm, content, no longer restless. And we can be too when we accept our limits. The true wisdom begins when we accept our limits. How do we do that? Well, we stop trying to figure it all out and hold it all together. We can't understand fully the mind of our God, the blessings and troubles he chooses for us. To do that, it's like to chase after the wind. Another image from Ecclesiastes. It just wears us out. Now, it's not that nothing matters. There are clear parameters that God gives us. There's no kind of excuse for wandering through life, harming ourselves and others. But I think it also means that we can be less paralyzed by fear and try more things. God doesn't let us know the outcome of our decisions before we make them. But we try to choose our best based on what is clear. Zach S. Wine comforts us with these words. At the end of the day, whether we choose poorly or well, God will not leave us and will walk through it with us onto the other side and beyond. For example, I did a fourth counselling day in the latter half of last year. It seemed to make sense, but there was some risk and uncertainty in doing that. Sometimes I've wondered since, did I make that change too soon? Was it the right call? But God has been with me He'll continue to guide and lead. The pressure's kind of off in terms of having to get it all right. He knows that we're not working with everything that he can see. We just do the best that we can within our limits. Well, today we've seen the teacher tells us true wisdom begins where our human control ends. And he's helped us to see three ways to give up our control. And true wisdom begins when we submit to God, when we fear him, and when we accept our limits. Let me close with a quote from Zach Eswine before leading us in prayer. Now, what's our experience like from this part of Ecclesiastes? This is how Zach puts it. Every bit of our skin and bone, thought, imagination, and feeling, every minute pleasure of our prosperity, every glass shard of our adversity is held, governed, and seen through to us by God.